Well, good morning, men. How y'all doing today? All right. It's good to see you. Hope all is well. I wanted to start by just kind of reminding you of what happens when guys get out of the city together and specifically get around a campfire. I think that guys kind of take on three types of roles around a campfire, especially if you're out at a ranch, something like that. There's three types of guys. You have to determine which one you are, okay? First type of guy around the campfire is the sit back and relax guy. He is the guy who finds his seat and doesn't move from it, all right? He sits down, and if the fire starts dwindling, he just assumes that the fire has run its course, okay? Because he's not moving. So he's a sit back and relax guy. The second type of guy around the campfire is the lighter fluid guy. I don't know what it is, but whenever guys get around a fire and a bottle of lighter fluid is introduced, it kind of just, this pyro gene that's been dormant just kind of comes alive in guys, whether guys in middle school or middle-aged, all right? It doesn't matter. It just sparks something, literally, inside of them. And so, man, guys can just sit there and spray the fire and giggle like a little girl and then pass the bottle and do the same thing for hours. It's incredible. It's the second guy. So there's the sit-back-and-relax guy, there's the lighter fluid guy, and then third, there's the cultivator, okay? He's the guy that you rarely see because he'll disappear into the woods for, like, 20 minutes. Then come back with like dragging a tree with him, and he takes his, you know, axe off of his belt that he just happened to have right there, chops it up, puts on the fire. He's the guy that he's, you know, you'll see him on his knees blowing into the fire, and then he'll enjoy it for a few minutes, and then he'll take off into the woods, and you won't see him for a little bit longer. There's the sit back and relax guy, the lighter fluid guy, and the cultivator. And the reason I kind of bring that up is number one, I think that that's a good picture for your relationship with God. You know, you're going to take one of those three types of roles. You're going to be the sit back and relax guy who you want the fire. You want that relationship with God. You want it to be a great, strong, warm fire, but you just don't want to put in the work that it takes to have a strong relationship with the Lord. Or maybe you're the lighter fluid guy. You're event driven. You kind of jump from thing to thing to kind of douse the fire of your faith. Flares up and then dwindles back down. Or you're going to be the cultivator, the one who is committed to progress. There's times where it feels good and times where it's work, but you're committed to it, okay? So I want to put that picture in your mind as you go through this weekend, as you seek to just take to gain traction with the Lord. But I also think that that's really a picture for our relationships, especially our romantic relationships. And some of y'all wouldn't even equate that word romantic to your relationship with your spouse. So I just need you to know, I'm talking about like your relationship with your spouses, or if you're single, your dating relationships, your future relationships. I think that those pictures, that picture of a fire, is a really good picture for romantic relationships, because you're going to fall into one of those three types of roles. A sit back and relax guy, where again, you want that great, strong relationship with your spouse or with the girl that you're dating, but you don't want to put in the work that it takes to make it strong. So you sit back and you watch while it dwindles. Or maybe you're the lighter fluid guy, especially if in a dating relationship, man, you so badly want to feel the passion and the heat of romance that, man, you spray the relationship of your life with lighter fluid. You douse it with messing around or sex or something like that, just so that it'll flare up and feel like love. But when all of that lighter fluid burns off the wood, you realize that there's really nothing there. Or the same in your marriage, man. You can just be event-driven, okay? It's like Valentine's, okay? I better come strong this Valentine's Day. So there's Valentine's Day, there's your anniversary, there's her birthday, and there's Mother's Day, okay? So it's just kind of event-driven, where you kind of, you go from thing to thing, kind of dousing the fire of your relationship, and then in between it dwindles down, and then it flares back up. Or you're going to be a cultivator. And you're going to be someone who puts in the time, the work that it takes to cultivate a strong relationship that's warm. And it's not just a blessing to the two of you, but it's actually a blessing to several people around you. So here's what I want to do this morning is I want to open up the Song of Solomon, God's instruction manual on finding love, making love, and maintaining love. And I want to give you six clarifying questions to ask yourself that will help make sure that you are cultivating the right relationship. Okay, so Song of Solomon, open up with me. For the college guys in here, if you were at the All Men's Breakaway this week, I'm not going to give you the same questions as this week. I am going to give you one question that is the same, but I'm hoping that this will, especially for you college guys, just to continue to give a vision, continue to give you a vision for what God desires for you. But let's look at this together. Song of Solomon. This book is amazing. I mean, if you've never spent any time in it, just look at the first couple of lines. It'll tell you just how great this book is. Verse 2, and the way that the book works is there's a guy and a girl going back and forth, kind of talking at each other. And the book gets us. God gets us, because in the Song of Solomon, the girl talks like 53% of the time, and the dude talks like 39% of the time, and then other people talk the rest of the time. So I think it kind of gets us, okay? The girl does the majority of the talking. God is relevant. He gets guys. All right, so here we go. Verse 2, here's how it starts. The girl's talking. She says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." This is extremely uncomfortable to read just in a group of guys, all right? So we're just going to kind of power through this together. But man, just think about this girl talking about a guy like that, saying, "Man, I want him to kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, and his love is better than wine." You think about wine, it is warm, it is intoxicating. She's saying his love is even better than that. And then she says this, and for you college guys here, this is where it's just going to be the same for a minute, and I hope that this is just a good reminder for you. But she says this, she says about her guy, she says, "Your anointing oils are fragrant." So she's talking about his physical smell. You need to know that in the ancient Near East, they didn't have water on tap. And so water had to be brought in, which means people didn't shower every day. Instead, they would use oils or fragrances to kind of mask their musk. Okay, some of you are like, "The Bible gets me." All right, like this. Okay, probably need to step up the showers a little. But she's saying, "Man, he smells good." And then she shifts in what she says. She says, "Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out." And what you need to know is someone's name referred to their reputation and character. And so what she does here, she switches from his physical smell to the metaphorical smell of his character and reputation. And so what she's saying is, "Man, my guy smells good inside and out." And it brings us to our first question. And here it is. Don't miss it. How does your name smell? It's a good question to ask yourself. How does your name smell? Like, when your name is mentioned in a group, is there something funky or fragrant in the air? When you walk into your house and your wife and your kids come around you, do they smell something that draws them in or something that kind of repulses them? How does your name smell? And as I challenge you college guys on Tuesday, you know, the goal is that when people come around you, it's not long before they begin to smell that you have been around Jesus. I think about this time when my son Noah, when he was the first kid, first grandkid on either side of the family. So he was just spoiled as a kid. And when we went to Christmas, the first Christmas, we literally rarely got to hold Noah because one of his grandparents was always holding him. So the rare occasions that I got to take Noah in my arms, it wasn't long before I would get this whiff of old lady perfume. Because it was really clear to me that he had either been with Tata or Nana, one of his two grandmas. And I just thought, man, that is the goal for us guys, that when our wives get around us or girls get around us or our kids get around us, it's not long before they get a whiff of Jesus because they smell that we have spent time with him. That's what happens when a guy puts his faith and trust in Jesus Christ, when he realizes who Jesus is and what he has done. And after doing that, he begins the process of surrendering his life to him on a daily basis. That's what happens when more and more every day you realize what it's like to make him the Lord of your life. This is what happens when guys get into accountable relationships with each other and we come alongside and we fight for one another and we push one another towards Christ. Is you begin to smell as if you've been around him. And that's what we're aiming for. And as I challenged you college guys on Tuesday night, a man that smells as if he's been around Jesus is a man who smells of conviction, not compromise. Conviction, not compromise. You think about what you do on the weekends. Do you smell of conviction or compromise? How you talk when you're around your wife, your kids, or your friends, do you smell of conviction or compromise? When it comes to being a gentleman, are you a man of conviction or compromise? Your interaction with other women, conviction or compromise? Here's the interesting thing. Look over at verse 12. Song of Solomon. Here's what she says. She says, "While the king was on the couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms." What you need to know is women would wear a bag of perfume around their neck while they slept so that they would smell pleasant the entire next day. And so what she's saying is, man, my guy, his presence in my life makes me smell good. So look at what she's saying here. She's saying he smells good physically and his character and reputation smell good too, but then when he gets around me, it makes me smell good as well. So guys, what this is saying is you don't just have to worry about how you smell, you have to worry about how the people around you smell because of your presence in their lives. And so it's just good to ask yourself, how do your wife and kids smell because of your presence in their lives? Do they smell funky or fragrant due to your presence? You know, I'll just be honest. One thing that I really struggle with is I struggle with a critical spirit, critical nature, and being negative. And so something as I've just been processing this is, man, how does that make my wife and my kids smell when I come into the household and I'm negative or critical? If you wear stress and anxiety around like a badge of honor because of how much you work, like there's something noble about always being stressed, just imagine how it will make your household smell. You know, if no one can ever be good enough for you, imagine how that will make the people in your household smell. It's a good question to ask ourselves. How does your name smell? Because how you smell will impact how other people smell. And I just want to be really clear right now what I want your response to be to this, okay? Because I think it's really easy to hear some of these things and to maybe feel some guilt or some shame for how you do smell right now. Let me just say, we all need to freshen up in one way or another, all right? We all have some areas of our life that are getting a little ripe, and they need to be freshened up. And that's why we all need Jesus, not just at conversion, but every single day of our lives. We need Jesus to step in and to freshen up the areas of our life that still smell bad. And so the response that I want you to have is not one of guilt or shame, but just continual surrender. To just realize some areas in your life that might stink and to just say, Jesus, I want to give this area of my life over to you. And I want to take some steps. I want to take some ground. I want to see progress in my life. I want to smell a little better in this area. All right? It's the first question to ask yourself. Here's the second question to ask yourself. Get to it. Is my relationship more like spring or winter? Is my relationship more like spring or winter? Look at chapter 2, verse 8. This is Solomon and his wife. They're not married yet. They're kind of in the dating process. And here's what it says. Solomon is coming to visit her. And it says, this is the girl talking. She says, the voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. How does that sound, guys, for your girl to call you a young stag? Some of you are like, maybe I'm just a stag. All right, maybe not young anymore, but middle-aged stag. There's nothing wrong with that. All right, I'll go for that. Okay, behold, there he stands behind our wall. Now watch what he's doing. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. You can actually get arrested for that. I don't recommend doing that, but it says, my beloved speaks and says to me. Now watch what Solomon says to her. He says, arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away, for behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come. The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. Okay, this is way too much poetry for a bunch of dudes on a Saturday morning. Okay, but let me just tell you what's going on here. It's a picture of Solomon standing outside this girl's house. It says he comes leaping over mountains to get to her. This is a guy who cannot wait to see his girl, this young stag, coming to pick her up. And he's standing outside the house calling out to her. And what he does is he begins to describe springtime. He describes spring. He's talking about when the fig tree ripens, and he mentions turtle doves, and he's just, man, this guy is head over heels for this girl. But he's describing spring, because if you think about spring, spring is the time of year that is full of life. You think about springtime, man, you walk out in Texas after you've been in the Texas heat and it feels like you're standing in front of a blowtorch. You have the heat of Texas, but then you walk out into the springtime and there's those like 2 days in the spring where it's like sunny and 75 with a slight breeze, and you walk outside, the sunlight hits your skin, you feel that breeze, and man, you just get paralyzed because you're like, oh, everything is as it should be. Life is good. And he's describing the spring as a symbol of their relationship. He's saying it's spring outside and it is springtime in our relationship. Our relationship is full of life. He's not saying it's perfect, but he's saying that it is a place where there is a bunch of life. On the other hand, you think about winter. What is winter? Winter is the time when everything goes dormant or things die. You look around in winter, and it is very hard to find any signs of life. And so you need to be clear. A good question to ask yourself is, your relationship right now more like spring or winter? Guys that are single, let me just encourage you. You need to be able to recognize a relationship that is more like winter than spring. I'll just tell you this, single guys, before I dated and married my wife, I was in a relationship that was on again, off again for 2.5 years. And the Lord had to transform me between this relationship and my wife. I really need to be clear on that. But this was a relationship where I really hit rock bottom in it. It was on again, off again for 2.5 years. It was packed full of drama. I mean, we would have these hours and hours of conversation trying to figure out what we were because I wasn't leaning well or clear on how I felt about her. And then it was full of guilt and shame because we were going places physically that I never intended to go before in the marriage. And when I look back on that relationship, it's really easy for me to see that that relationship was a lot more like winter than spring. And it's very hard for me to look back and really see any signs of life. But I think that the reason that I stayed in the relationship, single guys, is because we were physically addicted to each other. We were physically addicted to each other, and so we just couldn't get away from each other. And because we would come together physically and it would feel like passion, and because there was passion, it would feel like life and love. But now that I think back on it, what I realize is the thing that I thought was making our relationship full of life was the thing that was actually making it more like death. And so, single guys, you need to know how to recognize a relationship that's more like winter than spring. And then for the married guys in here, you have to be able to be honest with your marriage. And you have to be able to come to a place where you're able to say, okay, it's a little bit more like winter than it is like spring, and we need to do something about it. One of the best things that you could ever do for your marriage is just call it what it is sometimes and say, you know what, this relationship is a lot more like winter, and we need help. We even need to go to counseling. We need to do something because we're struggling. One of the worst things you can do when your relationship, when the fire of your marriage is almost snuffed out, one of the worst things you can do is just sit back and relax, hoping that something is going to automatically come along and cause it to spark up again. Okay? That's one of the best things you can do, is call it what it is and just say, we need to get help. One of the best ways that you can cultivate the fire of your marriage might be to go to counseling. And there is nothing wrong with that. We all need counseling. That's why the Holy Spirit is called the counselor, because we all need counseling. Here we go. Here's the third question. Am I leaving my girl to wonder and wander? Okay, now watch this. Here's the question again. Am I leaving my girl to wonder and wander? I'll explain what that means in a minute, but I want you to see what Solomon does with his girl. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. She says this. She says, I am the rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. And then Solomon chimes in and says, as a lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women. And so while they are kind of in the dating phase, and they didn't really date back then, but I'm just saying dating phase because that's what's kind of what we know here in our society. When they're kind of in that phase, what we see the girl doing is expressing some insecurity, saying, you know what, Solomon, I'm a lily among lilies. Like, I'm just a common girl, you're king, you could have anyone you want. I'm just a lily among lilies. And then Solomon chimes in and says, you're not a lily among lilies, you are a lily among thorns. You are one of a kind. There is no one else like you. What we see him doing is recognizing her insecurity and speaking to it. Okay, now watch what happens when they step into marriage. On their wedding night, we get to be the creepy people standing in their bedroom, all right? And look at what he says, man. This is good material for the men to take home with them. But it starts out, behold, he says, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. And then he begins to work his way down her body. He says, your eyes are doves behind your veil. Take that one home with you. How about this? Your hair is like a flock of goats. Okay, probably you shouldn't take that one home with you, okay? Leaping down the slopes of Gilead. This one's even better. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them has lost its young. He's saying, baby, your teeth are all white, and they're all present, okay? What a win, all right? It's awesome. Amen. All right. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are halves of pomegranates behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David. It is fat. That's not what he's saying, okay? Built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, that gaze among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh, the hill of frankincense. And then verse 7, you are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. So here's what I want you to think about. And the thought here is that Solomon isn't just like taking inventory of her body. He's not like, hair, check, teeth, present, breasts, got them, awesome. Like, he's not taking inventory. The thought is that he's admiring her body. And the thought is that this girl is a virgin, which we see later in the passage. So the thought is that as Solomon mentions each one of these parts of her body, he possibly touches it. So this might be the first time that this girl is actually exposed naked in front of a man, being touched by a man. So I love how he starts. He starts in verse 1 by saying, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. And then he talks about each thing. He gets to her breasts, which are more intimate than her face. And after he gets to that, before he keeps moving his way down, he just stops again for intermission. Verse 7, he says, "You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you." So it's just this, I mean, it is on his mind that he wants to promote security in his wife. Now watch this. After they've been married for a while, we get to be the creepy people in the bedroom again. They have sex twice in the book. And look at how chapter 7 goes. It says, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals." Okay, "O noble daughter." Talks about her shoes. That's probably good because women have boxes of shoes, and so that's good, okay? And then watch what he talks about. He says, "Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a round bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat." Okay, guys, just real quick, don't ever refer to your wife's stomach as a belly, and never refer to anything on your wife as a heap of anything, all right? "Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle." Here's what I want you to see is what he's doing is he is mentioning every part of her body from her feet to her breasts. And the reason that that is so important is if you think about what a woman gets insecure about, especially when she's had kids, what is it? It's her thighs, it's her butt, and it's her breasts. Those are the things that a woman can get insecure about. So here we see Solomon yet again promoting security in his wife. And what does he even say? He talks about how he says, "Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat." He's saying, you're like wine, which is very enjoyable. And you're like wheat, which was the staple food in an Israelite's diet. So he's saying, your body is sexually intoxicating and satisfying. Here's why this is so important, okay? Single guys and married guys, you have to know this. At the core of the majority of women is a question. And the question is, am I loved? And that question has been put there by God himself so that he can answer that question in the person of Jesus. All right? Only Jesus can answer that question for a woman. All right? But she still asks the question. And I think God uses men, not just any man, but a woman's husband to help answer that question. And you need to know, she is prone towards insecurity, seeking to answer this question. And if you leave her to wonder what the answer is to that question, then she will wander into insecurity. Do you see that? If you leave a girl to wonder, she will wander into insecurity. She will. And so what we see Solomon doing is he continually promotes security in his girl. Guys, this is going to require you to use your words and communicate. Not just one time, but often. Okay? The worst assumption you can make is that your wife is convinced how much you love her. That's a bad assumption. Because if you say, "Well, what do you mean, do I love you? I mean, I pay the bills and I provide for you and I told you 3 months ago that I love you. What else do you want from me?" No. Just assume that if she hasn't heard it today, she's starting to wonder, which will cause her to wander in insecurity. Single guys, man, this is something that starts from the first date. I will never forget Brian and Tristy Fisher They said, "What's the point of a first date? Well, determine if you want to have a second date," which is really good to live by. But man, if you want a second date with a girl, you probably need to tell her, you know? If you have a good time on the first date, you should probably tell her at the end of the first date that you had a really good time and that you want to take her out again. And then if she says, "Yeah, that sounds good," well, I would say you have about 48 hours to call her and kind of set something else up. Because if you tell her, "I had a really great time," and then you wait 2 weeks, you know what happens during that 2 weeks? She begins to wonder. And because she begins to wonder, she begins to wander into insecurity. You break up with a girl, you know what, guys? You let her go. You let her go. What you don't do is to communicate two totally opposing things. Where you say, hey, you know what? I like you. I have a really great time with you. I think you're awesome, but you know what? I think we need to break up. You know what you're saying right there? You're saying, I really like you, but I don't like you. And if you tell a girl, I don't really like you, I don't really want to be dating you, but then after you guys break up, you're texting her like, hey, I was just thinking about you, wondering how you're doing. Hey, I saw this, and it reminded me of you. Hey, do you want to get together and hang out? You know what you're communicating? You're communicating, I don't like you, but I like you. And it'll cause her to wander. It'll cause her to wonder and wander. Married guys, I think about what the Solomon's girl says in chapter 7, verse 10. She says, I am my beloved's and his desire is for me. I think that that's pretty amazing because what she is saying is I am convinced that his desire is solely for me and I'm not having to compete for his desire. I'm not competing for his desire. His desire is solely for me. She is confident in how he feels about her. And this demands that we just pause here and talk about pornography again. Because when you think about what porn does, what porn will do is it will force your spouse to compete for your desire. So what it will do is it will force your spouse to compete for your desire. And if your spouse has to compete with an airbrushed model, she will never win. Never. If she's forced to compete for your desire, watch the progression. Watch how things will unfold. Okay? Competition will breed insecurity. Insecurity will breed anger. Anger will breed withdrawal. Withdrawal will breed separation. And separation can even breed divorce. That's the progression. So a good question to ask yourself is, am I leaving my girl to wonder and wander? Next question is this, am I a problem solver or a problem spreader? You a problem solver or problem spreader? Look at chapter 5. This is when the couple kind of has their first conflict. Just watch how it plays out because I think some of us can probably identify with this. Verse 2, the girl says, I slept, but my heart was awake. What she's saying is I'm having a restless night's sleep. And here's kind of what happens. She says, a sound, my beloved is knocking. And here's what he's saying. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is what would do my locks with the drops of the night. You know what that is? That is a guy who wants to have sex. That's what that is. Okay, if you don't realize it, Solomon is reaching back to his wedding night, pulling some of his best material, saying, my sister, my bride, my love, my dove, my perfect one, please open the door. All right? And here's what she says. She said, I had put off my garment. How could I put it on again? I'd bathed my feet. How could I soil them? All right? Guys, you know that piece of that article of clothing that your wife has that's really comfortable for her to wear and really uncomfortable for you to look at? You know what I'm talking about? Like, they all have them. Like, for my wife, for the first several years of our marriage, it was a pair of these shiny green pants that ballooned out at the hips and then tapered at the bottom. The only two people to wear these pants are Genies or MC Hammer. All right, those are the only people who wore these pants. Okay, my wife doesn't own them anymore for obvious reasons because we have discarded of them. But I knew that when the Genie pants were on, it was not my night. All right, it wasn't. I knew it. So here in this story, what the girl is saying is she's saying, hey, the Genie pants are on. All right, the Genie pants are on, and I have washed my face. Genie pants are on. How could I take them off again? I'm like, I know a way. Okay, we can actually take them off, and you can never put them on again because we can burn them, all right? But here's the tension. Verse 4, my beloved put his hand to the latch. My heart was thrilled within me. I rose to open to my beloved. My hand dripped with myrrh. My fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. So she's in bed. Solomon is trying to pursue her. She shuts him down. And then, you know, that happens sometimes in marriage. And that's not sinful for a girl to not want to have sex. But in this particular section, in this particular moment, I think she's feeling convicted that she might have been stubborn or selfish when Solomon was pursuing her. And so she gets up, goes after him, and he is already gone. And really, for the first time in the book, we see separation, because that's what sin does. Sin separates. Greed will separate. Selfishness will separate. Stubbornness, it will separate. So what sin does is it drives a wedge. It separates. And what ends up happening is I think that the girl goes back and falls asleep and begins to have a dream. And in this dream, God begins to show her how to make things right. Watch what it says. Verse 7, it says, "The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls." I don't think that this is reality where she's getting beat by some watchman, because she's the queen. All right, no watchman's going to beat the queen. But I think what this is the conviction of God upon her. God's kind of convicting her and showing her where she went wrong. Where what you need to realize is when there is conflict in your relationship, you need to make room for the conviction of God in your life. One of the best things you can do is step back for a second, just ask the question, God, where am I wrong in this situation? Because I'll tell you this, guys, you want to know the three most miserable people to be around? Here are the three most miserable people to be around. Number one, the person who's never wrong. It is really difficult to be married to someone who is never wrong and always right. Number two, the person who gives really bad apologies, because they say, "I am sorry, but," and then they say, "I'm sorry, but here's why I'm not really that sorry, because of what you have done." Third person who gives fake apologies by saying, "I'm sorry you got your feelings hurt." That's not an apology, right? "Hey, I'm sorry you got your feelings hurt." What you're doing is you're just redirecting the blame. Everybody needs to have a moment where you just pause and say, "Okay, God, what am I responsible for here?" And what we see the girl doing is in her dream, is she is pursuing Solomon, trying to find him and make things right. Good conflict resolution. You're either going to be a problem spreader or a problem solver. A problem solver is someone who goes to the person you have wronged. You don't go and spread the problem and go to someone else. You don't go to social media for your younger guys and just kind of spew on there. You don't call your friends. You don't go get a beer and talk about how miserable your spouse is being. You don't spread the problem. You solve the problem. You go to the person. And then you see what happens in her dream. She goes to her friends seeking help. And here's what they say in verse 9. They say to her, "What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you adjure us?" What they are asking in her dream is a question that she might ask herself in reality. And what they are asking is, what is so great about Solomon? Couldn't you do better? And this is so important, guys, because when conflict happens in your marriage, where there is a separation because of sin, you have to realize that you have an enemy seeking to steal, kill, and destroy from your marriage. One of the best ways he can do that is by asking a question. Couldn't you do better? Couldn't you do better? What makes your wife so great? And it becomes a question of comparison, because you can't answer that question, couldn't I do better, unless you actually begin to compare your spouse to someone else's spouse. And I'll tell you this. You think about, if you, guys, you need to know, man, if you allow yourself to compare your spouse to someone else or to someone else's spouse, here's what you will do. Please do not miss this. Here's what you will do, is you will compare your spouse's weaknesses to a mosaic of other people's strengths. You will compare your spouse's most undesirable qualities to a mosaic of other women's most desirable qualities. And your spouse will lose every single time. Comparison will kill. And so what we see in her dream is God just showing her. These girls ask the question, and then she just immediately starts thinking about all of the things that she loves about Solomon. All of the things. She just begins to rattle them off to the point where she gets to the end. Verse 16, she says, his mouth is most sweet. He is altogether desirable. One of the best things you can do when you are in conflict is just pause and try and remind yourself of one thing that you appreciate about your spouse. Because when you do, it will just kind of remind you how ridiculous your argument probably is. There's times where I'm fighting with my wife, Catherine, and I would just begin to, there's times where I've thought like, oh man, my wife is hilarious, most fun, the funniest girl on the planet. I'd rather be laughing with her, but instead we're in this, what are we really fighting about? Like, are we seriously fighting about this? And it just kind of brings things into perspective. And then what happens is she wakes up and she knows how to make things right. And she goes to find Solomon. And when she finds Solomon, who do you think would speak first? Well, probably the woman, right? Because she's the one who is the offender. Well, look at verse 4. It says, you are beautiful as Tirzah, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. You know who that is? That's Solomon talking. And guys, it is our responsibility to take the lead when it comes to conflict resolution, reconciliation in our relationships. And I'll just say, I think that the reason that Solomon is able to respond like this to his wife is, and I think it's Tommy Nelson who put it this way, but it's because he is responding to God instead of reacting to the person. Can you imagine how different your arguments would be if you responded to God instead of reacted to the person? See, we always want to react. But when you pause and just say, God, how do you want me to respond? Things change. And because he's responding to God, he's able to forgive. You know what forgiveness is, guys? Forgiveness is allowing yourself to be stripped of your right to justice. It is surrendering your right to justice. Justice is what we all want. We all want to say, well, if you hurt, then, or if you hurt me, then I have a right to hurt you. Or if you hurt me, then I'm entitled to an apology, and I'm entitled for you to try and make it up to me. Forgiveness is saying, you know what, I surrender my right to be right. I surrender my right for you to try and make things right. I'm surrendering my right for you to hurt just because you hurt me. And we can do that because of what Christ has done for us. You look at what he says in verses 5 through 7, chapter 6. It says, turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats. There it is again, leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins. Not one of among them has lost its young. Where did we hear that before? On their wedding night. So he's taking her back to their wedding night. He's saying nothing has changed. Because you know what? Conflict never changes commitment. Conflict never changes commitment. My love for you has not changed. You a problem spreader or problem solver? Here's the next question. Am I a conqueror or a cultivator? Conqueror or a cultivator? And here's why I ask this, okay? You look at chapter 7, and we looked at it earlier, but he talks about her thighs. He refers to her belly as a heap of wheat. And it's interesting because he's trying to keep things fresh, because on his wedding night, he started with her head and moved down. And then when they're into marriage, he starts with her feet and he moves up, which I like, because he's keeping things fresh. And this is really important, especially if you're married, because you know how routines go, right? It's so easy to slip into routines. And what routines do is that routines lead to ruts. But routines are nice because they're easy. They don't take effort. You don't have to plan or be intentional. So you can go to the same restaurant. You can watch the same TV shows. You can do the same things for foreplay and sex, and you can just slip into these routines that lead to ruts. Guys, we are notorious for being conquerors instead of cultivators. We use our best material prior to marriage, and we spend all of this effort, all of this time, all of this affection, all of this this money, everything. We spend everything trying to get them to say, I do. And once they do, it's like we conquered. We won. We got you. Now we slip into laziness and apathy. We're conquerors instead of cultivators. Guys, I think our best material should be after we get married. I think our wives should get our best dates, our best material. But it takes work. Organize a date. Get a babysitter. Go out and engage in deep, meaningful conversation. Cultivate. You know, I think people have affairs. I think affairs offer people an opportunity to step outside the routine. Let me skip on to the last question. The last question of is this: is my understanding of love biblical? Look real quick in chapter 8. I'll just say this. Let me ask you a question I want you to respond to. If I were to say, what is the famous love passage in the Bible, what would you say? 1 Corinthians 13. We know 1 Corinthians 13 as the love passage in the Bible. It's actually the most quoted text in wedding ceremonies, 1 Corinthians 13. But I don't know if you realize this, 1 Corinthians 13 is not about romantic relationships. That chapter actually exists to explain what love should look like in the church community as people recognize their gifts and then serve the body. That's what love is supposed to look like in the church. And thankfully, God's definition of love inside the church is really the same as love inside of the marriage, but Song of Solomon chapter 8 is actually the love passage in the Bible for romantic love. In fact, this is the passage that I try and go to when I officiate weddings, because this is what spells out what love is supposed to look like in a romantic relationship. So let's look at it just real quick. Here's what the girl says. She says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. A seal was a stone that someone would wear around their neck, or it'd be a custom ring that had a symbol on it, and they would stamp something in wax as a sign of ownership. What she's saying is, you know what love does is it takes ownership. And she's saying, I want you to set me as a seal. I want you to belong to me and only me. That's what happened when you took vows. When you stood on an altar, what you're saying to your wife is, I want to belong to you and only you. And the same goes for me. I want you to belong to me and only me. We take ownership of each other. And then she says this is beautiful. She says, for love is as strong as death. It was common for people in the ancient world to relate feelings to death to show how intense that they were. You think about death. Death is final. It is permanent. No one ever dies and changes their mind, right? No one says, I tried death. It really wasn't for me. So I'm just going to go another way. All right? No, death is final. It's permanent. It's irreversible. She says, you know what? Our love is as strong as death. It is permanent. It will not change. You know what this means? This means that love isn't something that you fall in or out of. Love isn't primarily a feeling. Love can be a feeling, but love is a choice. It's a daily decision that we make. I think I've done several weddings in my life, and there is one that has ended in divorce. And I will never forget standing on the altar with them, not wanting to pronounce them husband and wife, because I felt like I could just see this marriage isn't going to end well. And it did end in divorce. And the reason that it ended was because the woman fell out of love with the man. And the problem was that she didn't have a correct understanding of love, because she believed what she was entitled to was a romantic fairy tale love that you see on TV shows and movies. She didn't want to believe that love was a choice that you have to make in thickness and in thin, good times and the bad. And so I'll just tell you this, guys, you have to remember what you said in your vows. You said, I promise to love you, sickness and in health, for better or for worse, until death do us part. And that's what you said. And those vows aren't just a formality on a day. That's actually a commitment you make to your spouse before God. And so if you didn't mention any caveats in your vows, then God will hold you to what you said. So if there are any caveats to your love, you might need to get your vows amended. And here's what I mean by that. If there are caveats, then you just need to tell your spouse, here's my caveats. Like, I promise to love you in thickness and in thin, as long as this is still working out for us. As long as my needs are being met. As long as you don't hurt me. As long as the sex is still good. If there are caveats to your love, you probably need to say them. And if you're single, before you get married, you make sure you put all your caveats out on the table. But a biblical love is a love that is strong as death. It's not something you fall in or out of. She says this. She says, love is jealous. She says, love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. That word jealousy, it implies intense passion. She's saying love is passionate as the grave. The grave doesn't share a body with anyone. She's saying true love is passionately exclusive. It's not to be shared with anyone outside the marriage. We do not make our spouses compete for our desire. She says flashes. Are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. Then she says something, one more thing in just a second. But what she's saying, you picture a flood. Love is like a fire that floods can never put out. It is unquenchable. I did a Google search on all the different reasons, the top reasons people get divorced. Here they are. Growing apart, lack of commitment, communication problems, finances, not enough attention, infidelity, spouses, personal habits, differences in taste, marrying too young, and alcohol and drug problems. True love is a fire that even when these floods come, it cannot be put out. It can't. And then she says, if a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. She's saying love can't be purchased. And because it can't be bought, it can't be sold. Because it can't be earned, it can't be lost. Because true love is unconditional. It's unconditional. It's a choice. It's not contingent upon what you do. It's freely given and it's freely received. My in-laws have been married for about 38 years. And I remember my wife just making an observation about her parents. She said this, and I loved it. It was so good. She said, my parents both have quirks that should drive the other crazy. But they just don't care. Neither of them care. And I loved that. Because marriage is two imperfect people having to come together and figuring out how to thrive and not just survive in marriage. You have your quirks. And you expect your spouse to love you in spite of your quirks. Hopefully we as men can do the same for them. You know, where have we seen this type of love before? Well, we've seen it in Jesus Christ. Ephesians chapter 1, 13 and 14 says that we've been sealed with the Spirit of God once we have believed the gospel. Romans 5, 8 says that God's love for us is as strong as death, that God demonstrated his love for us and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Love is a fire that can't be quenched. We see that in Romans 8 where Paul says that nothing can separate us from the love of God. This is the love that we have experienced. If we say that we are believers in Jesus Christ, and we are saying that this is the love we have experienced, and once we experience this love, the only right thing to do is express this love. So these are six questions to ask yourself if you want to cultivate the fire of not just your faith, but your romantic relationships. You're either going to be a sit back and relax guy and you're going to sit and watch the wish for the fire, but you're just going to watch it dwindle. Maybe you're going to be the lighter fluid guy. You're going to be event driven, or you're going to be the cultivator, the one willing to do the work that it takes to have a warm, enjoyable fire with your spouse. Let's pray together. And guys, I'll just remind you as we go to pray, my hope for you is that your response to this wouldn't be guilt or shame. If there's conviction in your life, that's good, but don't let that conviction drive you to despair. Allow that conviction to move you towards Jesus, to just find forgiveness for who you've been or what you've done, but just to surrender an area of your life to him and invite his lordship into that area of your life so that he can begin to make change. And so in this moment, I think we all need the grace of God. We all need God to speak into our lives and speak grace over us and forgiveness over us. And so even just in this moment, if there's something in the quietness of your own heart you need to confess to the Lord and just ask for his forgiveness for, you do that and you just sense his grace covering over you. And if there's something he puts on your heart that you need to go call your spouse today and just ask for forgiveness for, or something like that, then take action and do it. But if anything, I hope that two things come out of this. Number one is surrender. And number two, it's accountability. That you would even see more than last night your need for a couple Nathans to step into your life and help fight for you to be the man God wants you to be in your marriage. So Jesus, we need you and we thank you for your grace and forgiveness. We thank you that you have actually canceled out the whole entire record of our sins. The whole record, which includes everything that we have done, past, present, and future. You've taken it. You've nailed it to the cross. So because of you, we are clean and we are new. We are new in this moment. And we have new opportunities moving forward. We can't change who we've been, and that is okay, because you, Jesus, can change who we will be from this day forward. So we just pray for movement. We thank you for who you are and what you've done, and for the love we've experienced from you. May we express that love with the people we love. In Jesus' name, amen.